richest executives in this country are saying that they can't afford to pay 15 now, when what they make in a single day is what they're paying their workers for a whole year, and it's just not right. We need to make some serious changes in this country. I'm running for a Green New Deal. I want to create public jobs at a living wage. We think this can be done in this country if we just stop the greed. This cycle of greed that goes on in this country has to end today, and that's why I'm here supporting this movement.
My name's Chasman Kevich. We're just fighting for workers' wages out here. All workers, fast food workers, construction workers, laundry workers, all workers. Workers are getting screwed in this country. We can't have that. We got to stick together and get better wages, better living conditions, better life. Too many rich people not sharing the wealth, and we're just working hard. We want our fair share. That's all.
Some of the protesters outside a McDonald's in Brooklyn, fast food workers in 230 cities are walking off the job as part of the fight for $15 and a union campaign, a push for a $15 an hour minimum wage. Organizers are calling it the largest ever mobilization of underpaid workers. And that does it for our broadcast. Special thanks to Hani Masood for that report. By the way, we're looking to hire a social media producer, a full-time job. Visit our website at democracynow.org for details. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Aaron Mata, Nermeen Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Okhtoff, Ani Masood. I'm Amy Goodman. Our website's democracynow.org. Thanks so much for joining us.
You've been listening to Democracy Now! Here on KBOO Portland. Up next is the volunteer-produced evening newscast. And first, we have some important messages.
It's good to be back here. It's good to see all you again. Take it, dude.
April 15th is Joey Ramone Day, so join me, Marcel, from 8 to 10 p.m. as we celebrate 2 hours of nothing but the Ramones. That's right. So grab a slice of pizza, turn your stereo up real loud, and keep it right here to 90.7 FM as we celebrate Joey Ramone Day from 8 to 10 p.m. on Wednesday, April 15th.
Let's go!
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Sex Workers film series hosted by the Clinton Street Theater. This month, the film A Kiss for Gabriella will be shown Tuesday, April 21st at 7 p.m. Gabriella Lita is the first sex worker to run for Brazilian Congress. A Kiss for Gabriella tells the story of her 2010 campaign as she faces 822 opponents and challenges a male-dominated political system to see if a sex worker, activist, wife, mother, and cultural icon can beat the odds and win the election. Again, that's A Kiss for Gabriella, Tuesday, April 21st at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
Up on the KBOO Evening News, protesters in Portland rally for a $15 minimum wage.
A Florida mailman lands a small aircraft on the lawn of the U.S. Capitol in protest of Citizens United.
And we'll hear from candidates vying for a spot on the Multnomah Education Service District's board.
Good Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, April 15th, 2015. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Jenka Soderberg. Hundreds of people marched in downtown Portland today in solidarity with national protests calling for the minimum wage to be raised to $15 an hour. Rallies were planned in 200 U.S. cities today, with fast food and other low-wage workers staging walkouts to call for a raise in the minimum wage. Protesters gathered at O'Brien Square in Portland today. The march stopped briefly at City Hall and ended at Portland State University. Organizers announced plans to introduce a ballot measure to raise the state's minimum wage incrementally to $15 an hour by 2019. Oregon legislators have introduced similar measures in the state legislature. Currently, cities in Oregon are prohibited from setting their own minimum wage, but Multnomah County has raised wages for employees as a result of the movement. At the federal level, President Barack Obama has proposed raising the federal minimum wage to $10.10 an hour, a move opposed by Republican lawmakers.
The rapid growth of oil trains in the Pacific Northwest now brings a new threat, a proposal for an unprecedented new oil refinery on the Columbia River. Recently obtained documents show Riverside Refining, LLC, is seeking a partnership with the Port of Longview to build an oil refinery in Longview, Washington, supplied by controversial oil by rail. This would be the first West Coast refinery constructed in over 25 years and the largest new refinery in the continental United States since 1976. The proposal to study the refinery with oil by rail makes the project even more controversial. Crude oil trains in North America have exploded a dozen times in the last 2 years, including an explosion that killed 47 people in Quebec. The company proposing the Longview refinery seeks a 50-year lease, the maximum allowed by state law.
There are hotly contested school board races going on right now across Multnomah County. But there's another election affecting local schools that you may not know about. Alan Montesillo has the story.
This is unrehearsed.
It is, yes. Yeah, you can just talk.
About 10 people sat around a table on a sunny day in southeast Portland.
Okay,
they came to talk about a big election that's happening in Multnomah County next month. And no, it's not the race for school board, although that's important, of course.
You all know me now, Siobhan Burke. I'm running for Multnomah Education Service District, Position 7. It's an open race.
So my name is Stephen. I'm running for MASD, Position 6. I grew up in a lower middle-income household in suburban Kansas City, in Section 8 housing.
Stephen Mark Baudouin and Siobhan Burke are running for the two open spots for the Multnomah Education Service District Board of Directors. I know that's a mouthful, and even MESD Board of Directors doesn't exactly roll off the tongue. But it is a really important election, and it isn't getting much exposure. So here's how it works. Everyone knows what a school district is. Districts themselves don't produce 100% of the services that their students get. Some of those services come from the MESD. So it's a separate organization that provides things like special needs education, nurses, alternative schools, outdoor school, administrative support, and many other things. So the MESD provides all these services, and then the individual school districts in Multnomah County decide to buy those services based on what the districts say they need and what they want to pay for. Now, if you have read about the MESD in the news lately, it probably wasn't for something good. In March, the superintendent resigned under pressure from local district leaders who were unhappy with her leadership. And 2 weeks ago, the MESD fired Brett Bigham, who was the 2014 Oregon Teacher of the Year. He even got to meet President Obama. An MESD spokesperson claims that Brett Bigham missed too many classes, but Bigham says he was fired for his sexuality. Both Stephen and Siobhan mentioned Bigham's firing in the broader context of problems that the MESD has been facing. Here's more from their opening statements. You'll hear Siobhan first, and then you'll hear Stephen.
I was recruited by teachers because of a long contract fight, so I think they're concerned about getting the right people on the board who understand the working conditions and support a positive work environment. And the reason that I wanted to run is because I do work with students in the classroom, and I think it's really important to get that perspective on the board, because I think some of these bad decisions they've made maybe wouldn't have been made if they had voices included from teachers or nurses, staff, students, or families.
And public education was, I think, the thing that changed my life. Having a quality public education, having teachers that believed in me, teachers that supported me, teachers that challenged me, allowed me to become the person that I am today. That has always stayed with me, that belief that every student matters, every student with a disability or of any ability, every student of every color, every student of any background, any neighborhood, every student matters. And MESD clearly is in business to support those students that are the most vulnerable.
I wasn't allowed to record the entire conversation, but something stood out to me. Given how small the group was, I expected the conversation topics to be really specialized. But the kinds of things people brought up were pretty relevant to anyone who cares about education. Standardized testing, funding for school nurses, the right kinds of technology to help kids learn. These are issues that people care about. And even if most people don't have kids with special needs, most people probably want to make sure that special needs children get the right kind of support. I checked in with the candidates after the conversation was done.
How do you think the conversation went? What did you learn today?
I learned a lot of great things today in the conversation. I learned that, number one, MESD needs a stronger public profile, and more people need to know who we are and what MESD does. And number two, there are a lot of concerns. There are concerns based on what people have heard and seen in the news. There are concerns about leadership, concerns about the impact of leadership transitions on students. And number three is that there's a lot of community goodwill and a lot of great ideas.
Well, I learned that even really highly engaged parents and voters want to know more about MESD, and that, like me, they need more education. I've learned, obviously, a lot about MESD in the last month or two talking to different stakeholders, but that it's very important that MESD raises its public image by holding forums, by hearing from people that are served by MESD, and getting the news out about the services they do provide, whether it's school nurses or outdoor school.
The candidates for MESD Position 6 are Colby Clipston, Stephen Mark Boudouin, and Doug Montgomery. The candidates for Position 7, Zone 3, that's Southeast and Southwest Portland, are Siobhan Burke and Kay Bridges. The special election is on May 19. Before you mail in your ballot, make sure to do your homework. This is Alan Montecelio with KBOO News.
In Dallas, Texas, police have confirmed that they shot and killed an Oregon man last night during a pursuit. Colby Robinson was wanted by police in connection with a double murder that occurred in Southeast Portland last week. According to local police, Robinson executed Sutling Susie Chang and Dat Gary Pham and critically wounded Susie Chang's husband. Colby Robinson's aunt said he was in Oregon to celebrate his birthday when he allegedly committed the double murder. Robinson then returned to Texas, where U.S. Marshals began watching him. Yesterday, Robinson escaped surveillance, beginning a manhunt that ended in officers shooting him dead. One bystander was injured by gunfire. However, it has not been established if Robinson was armed.
A tornado touched down yesterday at Lane Community College in Eugene. The National Weather Service declared the tornado an F0, the lowest class of tornado. This small tornado managed to lift a few cars before it dissipated. One car was completely flipped, and another one, containing two passengers, was lifted from the ground and dropped. No injuries have been reported, and the damage was limited to four vehicles. Tornadoes are very uncommon in the Northwest, with only a few in the last decade. The last recorded touchdown of a tornado in this bioregion was on October 22nd in Longview, Washington. This type of weather mainly occurs in the spring and early summer in the Northwest, when heavy storms are more common.
A local robotics company has recently been purchased by Sealed Air, a North Carolina company that specializes in producing bubble wrap. Most people are familiar with bubble wrap as a packing material, but may be unaware that the same company also designs and sells machines for cleaning floors. The new partnership will bring an age of robotics that wander the halls cleaning without needing a floor plan programmed into them. Local company Intellibot Robotics has been developing robots that actually learn their environment, can be completely self-guided in tasks, and utilize wireless communication to send messages to staff, like when the robot is done cleaning. While no financial details of the merger have been released, Intellibot Robotics will maintain its current facilities and offices.
are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for news from the BOO with station co-manager Monica Beamer. This will be followed by Occupy Portland Radio at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will be sunny with a high of 72 and an overnight low of 45. Today in history, in 1947, Jackie Robinson made his debut for the Brooklyn Dodgers, shattering Major League Baseball's color barrier. The quote of the day is from Renaissance master and genius Leonardo da Vinci, born today in 1452, who said, "The noblest pleasure is the joy of understanding."
It's 5:15. Time now for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Even the word greed is not negative enough to characterize the all-out assault on workers by today's corporate elite. From offshoring jobs to busting unions, from slashing wages to looting pensions, corporate takeaways from America's used-to-be middle-class workforce certainly are driven by the avarice of top executives and wealthy investors. Plainly put, the more they can take from workers, the more they can put in their own pockets, or, most likely, in their offshore bank accounts. It adds up to a massive redistribution of wealth from the many to the few. In addition to greedy, though, these people are rank thieves. As Woody Guthrie succinctly put it, some will rob you with a six-gun, some with a fountain pen. We're now in a rapacious fountain pen economy. Since the Wall Street crash of 2008, itself a product of grand theft by financial elites, the productivity and creativity of all Americans have regenerated every bit of the wealth that was frittered away by bankers, and we created trillions of dollars in new income. What a phenomenal national achievement that is, produced in an astonishingly short time by the shared effort of our people. But strenuous effort is all we shared. The richest 1% of Americans have grabbed 91% of the gains in income, and the even richer 0.1% sucked up 22% of the new wealth. Thus, the vast majority of us have still not recovered the wealth we lost, homes, cars, savings, etc., and 99% of us are getting less income today than we were before Wall Street crashed our economy 7 years ago. This is Jim Hightower saying, it's time we robbies started talking plainly about what's going on. The rich are not getting richer because they're more enterprising than everyone else, harder working, or of stronger moral character. They're thieves, and they're getting richer by stealing from you.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
A man landed a small gyrocopter on the lawn of the U.S. Capitol today in an apparent act of protest that drew a large security response. Doug Hughes, a postal carrier from Florida, landed his aircraft with what he said were letters to each member of Congress urging campaign finance reform. Hughes was taken into custody by Secret Service agents shortly after he touched down. The event led to a shutdown of the area around the Capitol as security forces responded. The Capitol Police Bomb Squad searched the gyrocopter and found no explosives. Officials from the Secret Service and the Federal Aviation Administration said they had no prior knowledge of Hughes' plans and were unaware of his flight until shortly before he landed. Elements of the United States military, which are charged with patrolling restricted airspace around federal sites, also said that they had not seen Hughes' craft. The incident could be another controversy for the Secret Service, which has been criticized for its lax response to several security incidents over the past 6 months involving President Obama and the White House.
The U.S. House of Representatives is voting tonight on the latest effort to repeal the estate tax, which is a tax paid by only the top 0.2% of Americans. Republicans introduced the bill to draw attention to what they see as an unjust tax by bringing up the legislation at the annual tax filing deadline, which, by the way, folks, is midnight tonight. President Obama calls the plan a budget-busting handout to the nation's wealthiest families at a time when he says lawmakers should be focusing on the middle class. He's pledged to veto the bill if it passes both the House and Senate. Scott Klinger is Director of Revenue and Spending Policies at the Center for Effective Government. He recently wrote the piece, From Class to Caste, how the Congress is set to accelerate inequality by repealing the estate tax. I spoke with Klinger earlier today about the tax and what it will mean if it is repealed. Can you tell us a little bit about this estate tax and who it actually impacts?
Yes, the estate tax was first passed in 1916 in an attempt to control very deepening economic inequality at that time. And today it only affects about 2 out of every 1,000 people that die. Their estates have to pay the estate tax. The other 998 families who inherit assets from estates actually get a tax break because all of the capital gains taxes that they have accrued during their lifetime are forgiven at the time of death.
So we're talking about the extremely wealthy, people who are generally in the top 1%, and even just a small percentage of those who are impacted by this tax?
It's a sliver of the top 0.1%, not just the top 1%. It's about 5,000 people a year. Just to give you some frame of reference, 15 years ago in 2000, there was 50,000 people a year that 50,000 estates a year that paid the estate tax. And there's been reductions in the rates and increases in the exemptions over the years and a number of new loopholes that have been opened. So it affects a very, very small sliver of people. At the very least, you have to have $10 million per married couple. And with financial planning, it's probably quite a bit more than that before you have to even worry about paying any estate tax.
This has been talked about as a death tax on a lot of the major media. And do you think that is an inaccurate representation?
Totally. As I said, only 2 out of 1,000 people pay it. So they'd be the only ones that would be able to claim it was a death tax. For everyone else, it's a tax break at the time of death because all of their capital gains taxes, the appreciation on the value of their house, their increase in their stock portfolio, go away. They're forgiven. So if your grandmother bought her house 50 years ago for $15,000 and now it's worth $215,000, if she sold it the day before she died, she'd owe capital gains tax on the $200,000 gain or $40,000. If she doesn't sell it and dies, when you inherit it, the value increases as of the time of her death to the market value, and you owe no capital gains tax. So really, for inheritors, for most inheritors, the vast majority of inheritors, they're saving a lot of money under the current rules. One of the things that the conservatives say about this is that it's double taxation, that you pay tax all your life and then you get taxed again if you're very wealthy when you die. That's also a mistruth. A lot of this wealth has never been taxed. So think about Phil Knight or Bill Gates or Jeff Bezos. These guys all founded their companies, so they have stock that's worth pennies a share. If they sold it today, they'd be paying billions of dollars of capital gains tax, but they don't have to pay it because they haven't sold the stock. At the time of their death, all that capital gains goes away. So we looked at the payments that Bill Gates would owe, and I think he saved something like $20 billion under the current rules. If the estate tax went away, none of that would be taxed. So there's a lot of money that would be lost to the system.
So it seems like in this and these cases that you have presented, the very wealthy are being encouraged to hoard their wealth or to hold on to it rather than investing or spending it. And it seems kind of antithetical to a functioning economy in which money has to change hands in order for the economy to function. Do the people that are pushing this not know basic economics or don't care?
Well, I think they're most interested in unfettered accumulation of wealth more than they care for the economy. You're absolutely right. The money doesn't circulate. It doesn't create jobs. It just sits there. And so that's a real problem.
What about the American people? A number of polls have pointed out that people are very much in favor of less of this wealth disparity and this income inequality and want some of this to be distributed in a more equitable way, at least. Is the Republican legislature out of touch with the American people, or what is the reason that they're going forward with this despite public opinion polls pointing in the other direction?
Well, I think they pulled the wool over the eyes of a lot of people with this death tax claim that they've made that's just totally phony. So we're trying to educate people that it's a tax that only 2 in 1,000 people would ever pay. They talk about small businesses and family farms. There was 1,300 farms and family and small businesses that paid it in the last year, and 1,000 of those were big farms. So like 300 small businesses and farms. People don't lose their farms by and large because of this tax, and small businesses have ways that they can pass on to businesses without worry. So they've created a bunch of foils to cover the real interests of extremely wealthy Americans.
And so for the most part, if someone inherits a home or a farm, they won't have to pay this tax at all.
Right, unless it's a huge mansion, you know, no.
Does it appear likely to pass the House today? And if so, what's the next step?
Well, we expect it to pass the House. I think all of the Republican members of the House have co-sponsored it, and they have a majority. So, yes, it will probably pass. It will then move to the Senate. Senator Ron Wyden's in a really important position as the ranking member of the Senate Finance Committee, and he's been a very strong proponent of keeping the estate tax and recognizes it's an important tax for the United States. So we expect him to continue to be a leader. It may well pass the Senate as well, since they have Republicans have a majority of the Senate. But President Obama has been very clear that he will veto it, and we don't think there's enough support to override his vetoes.
Well, thank you so much for sharing this information with us. I've been speaking with Scott Klinger. He is the Director of Revenue and Spending Policies at the Center for Effective Government in Washington, D.C. He recently wrote the piece, From Class to Caste, How Congress is Set to Accelerate Inequality by Repealing the Estate Tax. You can find his work at foreffectivegov.org. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
The self-described toughest sheriff in America has been caught using a racial profiling to pick targets for police contact. The 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that the Maricopa County Sheriff's Department did, in fact, use race to assess whether to stop someone, particularly when it came to Hispanics. Sheriff George Arpaio has had a lot of controversy in his lengthy term as sheriff, appearing in court to answer for harsh labor camps, chain gangs, spoiled prison food, misappropriation of prison funds, and a list of other complaints that question Arpaio's decisions and his treatment of the public. Sheriff Arpaio is most known for a prison he calls Tent City, in which prisoners are forced to live in tents in the desert and spend their days doing hard labor in an environment that may reach 125 degrees in the summer. Arpaio defends his treatment of prisoners, saying they are criminals and that they are there to be punished. Prisoners of Tent City are sometimes awaiting trial and are legally considered innocent until proven guilty. However, Arpaio has publicly stated that his primary goal is to track down and lock up illegal immigrants to prevent future crimes.
A judge ruled today that General Motors may not be sued for faulty ignitions in vehicles produced before its bankruptcy in 2009. General Motors filed for bankruptcy in 2009, and a judge ruled that the company should be divided into the old GM and the new GM. The ruling today means that owners of affected vehicles that were produced before the bankruptcy must pursue their claims against the old GM company and not the new, financially stable GM. The old GM has an estimated value of $9.25 billion in comparison with approximately $32 billion in claims against the company. The judge ruled that plaintiffs must prove in court that the new General Motors is directly responsible for any claims that they may have.
Last week, we reported about a black transgender man in Georgia who was sentenced to 20 years in prison for shooting his rapist in self-defense. Kai Peterson was being raped outside a convenience store when he pulled out a gun and shot his rapist. Although DNA tests confirmed that Peterson was in fact being raped, local authorities charged him with murder and armed robbery. Peterson was also detained for over a year without access to a lawyer, and when he finally did see a lawyer, he was encouraged to take a plea deal instead of fighting his charges. The Advocate broke this story with an investigative piece on April 8th. Since then, the county jail has blocked access to Kai Peterson, and Pinky Shear, his partner, hasn't heard from him since. Alan Monticello interviewed Pinky Shear, Kai Peterson's life partner, who is leading the campaign to free Kai.
He is currently in protective custody or lockdown at Pulaski. I've had a couple of different reports. One person saying that he was put in lockdown because of an altercation with another woman in the facility. And then I had someone else say that he was put into lockdown because of the article that was published by the Advocate.
Is this sort of an indefinite thing, or is there a usual kind of procedure to how long someone's kept in?
This is not customary. Usually, if someone goes into lockdown for a offense like fighting or doing something wrong in Pulaski, their standard operating procedure is they take you to lockdown, and within 96 hours, you have a hearing, and they give you, you know, disciplinary report and whatever punishment you're going to get, and then send you back to a dorm. As of right now, it's been well over 96 hours, and he is yet to go to any kind of a hearing at all. And that's coming from his mom. His mom has told me that she contacted the facility, and they said that he has not yet been to any kind of a hearing at all.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which leads me to believe he's in protective custody because of the publicity from the advocate.
Right, right. Do you have a sense as to just how Kai has been doing in prison?
Kai is actually, he's doing remarkably well. Being a trans man, most trans men deal with dysphoria in different ways, and Kai is an environment where they actually have to do, if he's working a detail, they will strip search you going in of the detail at the beginning of the day, and then they strip search you coming out at the end of the day. And so that can be very, very uncomfortable for a trans man if you have to go through. They don't allow binders. They don't allow anything to make you feel like their primary goal in Pulaski is to remind you on a daily basis that you were born a female, and they will not acknowledge your transgender status in any way, shape, or form. The warden prides herself on having strong Christian values and so on and so forth, and therefore this is not acceptable in that facility. I think that there have been people who have been trying to get a hold of the warden and ask her how she feels about trans inmates getting the hormones, because now it's looking like it's going to be a requirement for the state to be able to provide those inmates. I am very, very excited about this. He's really, really excited. But when it comes to dealing with things like dysphoria and being harassed by staff, he's actually really funny about it, because he tries to make a joke about it. And he turns it around. Like, they try to make him feel uncomfortable, and they try to make him feel ashamed or whatever. And, you know, he'll turn around to, you know, whatever officer is there for that strip search, and he'll start stripping his clothes off like a Chippendale stripper, you know, and, hey, you want me to strip for you? And you know, he kind of makes a joke about it. And then they get irritated, and they're like, just put your clothes back on, Peterson, and go back to your dorm, you know. Mm-hmm. He has a really positive of who he is, and he's extremely vocal about it.
Right.
And that's what makes me so proud of him.
You mentioned earlier, is the state going to be required to give Kai hormone therapy?
Yes. The technicality is that the inmate has to already have, I believe, medical review or something that says that this person has gender identity disorder in order to get, you know, basically it's a gender identity letter which says, you know, this is what they have, and these are required for their mental and emotional health. Most inmates do not have such a letter.
For more updates on Kai Peterson's case, visit Kai Peterson, that's kypeterson.wordpress.com. You can also find information about him on Facebook and Twitter.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. For Chicago's Donald Jenkins, the fight for 15-day of action in 230 cities Wednesday is a struggle for economic and social justice, and also a struggle for future generations of working people.
If you never fought for anything in your life, fight for this living wage. so that the kids of our future can have a way that we didn't have. People lost their lives fighting for economic and social justice. Right now, today, we're fighting for a living wage, and people lost their lives fighting for things back in the days, like fighting to vote, to have the right to vote. And now here it is, we're sitting here fighting for a living wage. I feel like, man, it's a big cause. It's a positive cause, and I'm going to be down with it until we get that 15.
Corporations that keep wages artificially low in the U.S. are costing taxpayers approximately $153 billion a year. That's according to a report from the UC Berkeley Center for Labor Research and Education. State-by-state costs are revealed for the first time in this report. After decades of wage cuts and stagnation and health benefits rollbacks, the report found that most public assistance is now being paid out to working families. Ken Jacobs, chair of the Berkeley Center for Labor Research and Education, says when companies pay too little for workers to provide for their families, those workers rely on assistance programs. That leaves taxpayers subsidizing poverty wages. The report's authors note that raising wages would actually mean significant savings for state and federal government public assistance programs. In Connecticut, a bill in the state legislature would actually fine companies that pay low wages in an effort to recoup some of that public assistance subsidy. A separate report from the National Employment Law Project shows 42% of American workers make less than $15 an hour. With that many low-wage workers, the Fight for 15 movement has massive growth potential. More and more retail companies are using on-call scheduling where workers don't know what their shifts will be one day to the next. New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman is investigating the use of this on-call scheduling. Hector Figueroa, president of 32BJSEIU, says forcing workers to be available on demand and shifting schedules stops them from living full and satisfying lives. It's disruptive for the workers. As many as 43% of all retail workers in New York City are on this kind of schedule. Worker advocates are hailing Attorney General Schneiderman's probe, which they say is historic in both scope and depth. Workers Independent News is made possible in part through underwriting support from the United Auto Workers Union and from the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
A new material may be a game changer in cleaning up oil spills. Scientists have created a new material that's capable of allowing water to pass through it freely while blocking oil. Researchers at the Ohio State University Nanolab believe that they may be able to produce this material at a cost of about $1 per square foot. This seemingly magic material will be able to strain out the oil from waterways and oceans. The new material is a mesh of stainless steel coated in nanoparticles that trap oil. The design was inspired by the lotus plant, which has the ability to absorb water while shedding oils. Researchers say that the compound of nanotubes is mostly clear, and they believe that with more research, they may be able to create a clear solution that can be used in producing glass for automobiles and homes that is capable of shedding moisture.
The European Union, which represents 28 European countries, has filed an antitrust lawsuit against the internet search giant Google. The European Union accuses Google of giving preferred treatment to its own online store when users are searching for items to purchase. In Europe, Google accounts for 90% of all internet searches. The European Union alleges that small online retailers are pushed aside in favor of Google's own retail branch. They expressed concern that pushing out these small businesses ends up stifling innovation and competition. Google has 10 weeks to respond to the allegations, which may carry a penalty of 10% of the company's annual income. For Google, this works out to about $6 billion.
A protester disrupted a press conference at the European Central Bank in Frankfurt, Germany today, jumping on top of a table where ECB President Mario Draghi was speaking and throwing papers and confetti at him while yelling, "End ECB dictatorship."
Yeah. join the conference and start in a few minutes again.
We apologize for the brief musical interlude there. The protester was wearing a T-shirt with the same slogan. Draghi was escorted out of the room and returned after security detained the protester. The protester has been identified as 21-year-old Josephine Witt. ECB spokespeople have indicated she may have posed as a journalist in order to attend the press briefing, which detailed the bank's actions in its latest meeting. The ECB has been criticized, along with the European Union and International Monetary Fund, for imposing harsh austerity measures on countries experiencing debt as a result of Europe's protracted financial crisis. Protests marked the opening of the new ECB headquarters in Frankfurt last month as thousands marched and staged a blockade while some protesters set police cars on fire. Those protests led to 350 arrests and numerous injuries.
A group of migrants rescued by Italian ships off the coast of Libya have reported that some 400 people that were with them drowned. Officials with the United Nations High Commission for Refugees said today that the stranded migrants purposefully capsized their ship after spotting a nearby Italian commercial ship. 142 people were rescued by the Italian Coast Guard from the capsized ship 80 nautical miles south of the island of Lampedusa. The majority of the victims are said to be women and children who were in the boat's hold in order to avoid cold temperatures. More than 8,500 African migrants attempting to reach Italy have been rescued from the Mediterranean in the last 5 days. The current death toll for migrants crossing the Mediterranean this year stands at just over 900 people, on pace to eclipse last year's record total of over 3,000 people who died in the trek across the Mediterranean. Human rights groups have criticized Europe for what they say is an insufficient response to the flood of mostly sub-Saharan migrants who attempt to cross the dangerous Mediterranean route in order to reach Europe for safety.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Wednesday, April 15th, 2015. Israeli soldiers invade West Bank communities and kidnap 30 civilians, and in Gaza, tanks invade border areas. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Israeli soldiers invaded various parts of the northern West Bank district of Nablus, stormed and violently searched dozens of homes and kidnapped 27 Palestinians, including a journalist. The army also kidnapped 3 Palestinians in the West Bank district of Bethlehem. The Nablus office of the Palestinian Prisoner Society, PPS, said that dozens of armored Israeli military jeeps invaded Nablus after sailing off several neighborhoods and nearby towns and broke into dozens of homes before violently searching them, causing excessive property damage. In addition, soldiers invaded Hussan town west of Bethlehem, broke into and searched several homes, and kidnapped 2 teenagers. Also in Bethlehem, soldiers invaded Doha town and kidnapped a woman. The Bethlehem office of the Palestinian Prisoner Society said that the kidnapped woman is a mother of 3 children and that the soldiers violently searched the home, terrifying her children, and took her to unknown destination. In Gaza, a number of Israeli military vehicles carried out on Wednesday morning a limited invasion into areas east of Rafah and Khan Yunis in the southern part of the Gaza Strip. Media sources in Gaza said that several armored vehicles and 4 military bulldozers invaded the Nahda neighborhood east of Rafah and moved towards the northern part of the district before bulldozing lands in Al-Sharb Al-Asayil area, east of Al-Fukhari area, east of Khan Yunis. The soldiers also opened fire on Palestinian agricultural lands near Abu Raida area, southwest of Khuzza'a area, east of Khan Yunis. No injuries were reported, but the farmers had to leave their lands, seeking shelter and fearing additional Israeli violations and escalation. Moreover, Israeli fighter jets also flew over different areas of the coastal region, repeatedly breaking the sound barrier and causing panic among the residents, especially the children. And That's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Wednesday, April 15th, 2015, news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bandura.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032, extension 203. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Joe Aaron and Alan Montesillo. The producer is Mike Klepfer. Our engineer is Jimmy Tardy. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is myself, Jinka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You can find us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are their phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor Kate Brown's number is 503-378-3111. And Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Jenka Soderberg.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. Coming up